The school was first intended as a Geschwister-Scholl-Hochschule. They at first did not really think about making it a new Bauhaus. This was the suggestion by Max Bill, and that's a very important fact, of course. My name is Martin Mentele. I'm an art historian by training, and I work as the head of the HFG Archiv, the archive of the former Ulm School of Design, or in German, Hochschule für Gestaltung. As such, we are an external department of Museum Ulm, which is run by the city of Ulm in South Germany.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to the first bonus episode of my Bauhaus Faces episode about Max Bill. As promised, I will start publishing two bonus episodes starting as of today. In this first bonus, you will hear the original interview with Martin Mentele, head of the HFG Ulm Archive. In the podcast with him, Max Bill's widow Angela Thomas and the Bill filmmaker Erich Schmid, you already heard what he had to say about Max Bill's role in the development of the Volkshochschule Ulm into the official successor of the Bauhaus and how this era, after only a few years, came to an end for him. By the way, if you haven't listened to the Max Bill podcast, I advise you to do so. In 1 hour 15, you will hear a walk through Max Bill's life and art. It's wonderful, I promise. In this interview here with Martin Mentele, Max Bill plays a central role, but the actual star is the success story of the HFG Ulm, the Ulm School of Design. We talked about the original idea of the school when Inge Scholl and her future husband Otto Eicher initiated a school in memory of her siblings, Sophie and Hans Scholl, who were murdered by the Nazis in 1943 for distributing political leaflets at the University of Munich, and how that idea became something else when Max Bill entered the stage. Of course, we didn't leave out the role the Americans took in this play as Allied power in war-torn Germany and as financial supporters, but also as decisive force because of that. And we also talked a lot about the design icons of the HFG, the Ulm stool, the brown radio, Snow White's coffin, and the stackable tableware TC100. And guys, I have to be honest, after that interview with Martin Mentele, I immediately looked into eBay to find Snow White's coffin and see if I could afford it. But as in 1962, when it was designed and sold first, it still costs a fortune. What a shame. I would have loved to put that beautiful radio on my Hellerau sideboard from the same time in the DDR, designed by Bauhaus alumni Franz Ehrlich, and that way unite the two design icons from East and West Germany in one place. Well, maybe one day. Let's now get into that wonderful bonus episode. Just a quick reminder, this is only the first bonus episode. The second one, featuring Angela Thomas, Max Bill's second wife and widow and fellow doctor of art history, and her husband, the filmmaker and journalist Erich Schmid, who made this wonderful documentary, Max Bill, The Master's Vision, or in German, Das absolute Augenmaß. This interview focuses on Max Bill's life and is in German. This bonus episode will be published next week. So don't forget to look out for that one too. And also look out for the chapter images on your smartphone or tablet while listening to this episode. As always, I have compiled a selection of photos and images that illustrate every chapter. Especially when talking about the architecture of the HFG and the design icons, I find it tremendously helpful to actually see what we are talking about. I will also publish those images on my Instagram account where I am at Bauhaus Faces Podcast in a few days. I would like to thank Martin Mentele and the HFG Archive for providing me with extensive material and permitting me to use those wonderful photos of the Ulm School of Design for my podcast. And now, like always, just a very quick reminder to please, 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 please rate Bauhaus Faces on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and YouTube, and to share this podcast with other Bauhaus fans. Well, let's now dive into this bonus episode of Bauhaus Faces with Martin Mentele and shine a light on the Ulm School of Design. Thank you so much for making the time today to talk to me about the HFG and especially about Max Bill's role at the HFG Ulm. To get to Max Bill, we have to kind of talk about the HFG, the Ulm School of Design, first a little bit. How did the school come into being?
The school was first intended as a Geschwister-Scholl-Hochschule. And again, I have to talk first about Otto Eicher and Inge Scholl, the co-founders, together with Max Bill of this legendary school. Otto Eicher and Inge Scholl, they grew up in Ulm. And Inge Scholl, she is the older sister of Hans and Sophie Scholl. Hans and Sophie Scholl, who fought against the Nazi regime during the Third Reich. And in 1943, they were caught when they were distributing leaflets in Munich University. And after a show trial of only 3 days, they were murdered by the Nazi regime. That and the destruction of Germany and also of the city of Ulm was quite a traumatic experience for both Inge Scholl and her future husband, Otto Eicher. And when they came back after the war to Ulm, Otto Eicher started to organize lecture programs already in August 1945, which were highly successful. And here in Ulm, the Americans were stationed, and they sort of observed this. And they said, well, why don't you restart the Volkshochschule? The Volkshochschule was already there, but the new Volkshochschule was founded then in the late 40s. But not Eicher became director, but his future wife, Inge Scholl. And until 1948, it was one of the largest Volkshochschule in Germany with about 3,000 members. For non-German speaking listeners, the Volkshochschule are adult education centers where you can take courses and classes, but you cannot take any kind of degree. And within this Volkshochschule, they established itself a group, Studio Zero, or in German, Studio Null, with, of course, Eicher and Inge Scholl as members, but also other members, journalists, the director of the library at the time. And they were discussing different ideas and also the idea of founding a Geschwister-Scholl-Hochschule in memory of Hans and Sophie Scholl, meaning they wanted to establish a university-level education in Ulm, but focusing on general sciences like history, psychology, politics, of course, everything in order to sort of educate the younger generation in the sense of the new democratic system, because this was the main impulse for all of them, especially for Eicher and Scholl. They said, we need to do something that something like the Third Reich would never, ever happen again in Germany. This is really the basic impulse. And we sometimes talk also about the anti-fascist impulse of them for all the actions of the Volkshochschule and also, of course, later the Ulm School of Design. But as I said, first they intended this to become a Geschwister-Scholl-Hochschule. And so in 1948, they traveled to Switzerland, where they met Max Bill and also talked with him about this idea of a Geschwister-Scholl-Hochschule. And he was quite interested. And so they exchanged letters and they were eventually inviting him to join them in establishing or at least in developing a program, which he did. With the time, they also sort of found out that the American government would be interested in funding them, because after the founding of the Bundesrepublik, there was a lot of money, which was part of the Marshall Plan, and there was a special re-education fund with about 50 million marks. And the most important person in this complex on the American side is John J. McCloy. He was the High Commissioner for Germany at the time, and he found a silent agreement with Inge Scholl, saying that the American government would give 1 million mark in order to build the building if the German side would also give as much money. And so it was the big task for Inge Scholl to collect this money, which came from private and public sources. But it was really a very, very difficult task, because 1 million mark at the time was a lot of money, of course. And so eventually they had everything together. So in 1952, there was a big celebration where the check was handed over in the city hall of Ulm, and Bill could finalize the planning and they could start building. But already in 1953, they started the first course.
Yeah, well, why did they approach Max Bill in Switzerland? Why didn't they approach anyone else that had studied or taught at the Bauhaus before if they were interested in that kind of person?
As I said, they at first did not really think about making it a new Bauhaus. This was the suggestion by Max Bill. And that's a very important fact, of course, because Max Bill told them very early on that he thought it's not a good idea to name the school after Hans and Sophie Scholl in memory of what they did. Also because he said it's too nostalgic, it's too German, and they are not known outside of Germany as a resistance group, which is true actually at the time. And he said, well, why don't we try to reestablish the Bauhaus? Because he had studied at the Bauhaus briefly in 1927-28, and he had excellent connections with former Bauhauslers, as we call them in German. For example, Walter Gropius, the founder of the Bauhaus, 1919 in Weimar, and others. And this is also, of course, what intrigued the Americans, because they knew what the Bauhaus was. Certainly also because Mohol Notch had established the new Bauhaus in Chicago, but sort of 20 years after the closing of the Bauhaus in Berlin, it was quite well known. So the Americans quite early on decided to establish also Max Bill as the founding rector. And so we have lots of letters in the archives that are documenting this process, because we can then follow Max Bill's ideas, who he wanted to approach to teach in Ulm. And he eventually managed to find four former Bauhauslers to come to Ulm to teach classes. And also he is discussing with Walter Gropius the naming of the school and also part of the programming, actually. And so very early on, we can find a letter where he asks Walter Gropius for permission to use the name Bauhaus Ulm. And Gropius is answering that, of course, he may do that, but he should be aware that he sort of could awaken false expectations, and he would then have to take the brunt of it, was Gropius' phrasing. And Eicher also very early on opposed the idea of calling the project Bauhaus Ulm, because he said we wanted to put our own stamp of this project. And so they decided on the name Hochschule für Gestaltung, which again derives from the Bauhaus. The Bauhaus was called in Dessau, Staatliches Bauhaus Dessau, Hochschule für Gestaltung. And so they chose this subtitle as a name for the school in Ulm.
So why was it so natural for the Americans to decide on the Swiss Max Bill to become head of the HfG Ulm and not on Otto Eicher or Inge Scholl, for example, or anyone else from Germany?
I mean, probably we don't have any documentation about this, but I think it has to do with his being a Swiss person. I mean, he comes from a neutral country, so there is no sort of a speck on his vest, I would say. He is completely clean politically. And of course, at the time, he's a little senior than Otto Eicher and Inge Scholl. He was born in 1908. Inge Scholl was born in 17 and Eicher in 22. So he's the most senior person in the project and also a very well-known artist, not only in Switzerland, but throughout Europe and also worldwide. He has very good connections to South America at the time. And also he is sort of interacting with the UNESCO. He has very good connections to Paris and the artists seen there. So I think this kind of prominence was also promising in a way to make the school a success, because neither Eicher was known at the time and Inge Scholl, I mean, she was just very good in organizing, but she had no training in the arts. Her father had a tax control office and she had been educated within his office, but she did not have any other training. And Eicher, he just studied 1 year at the Munich Academy and then established himself as an independent graphic designer in Ulm. So they were completely unknown at the time. And Bill had already an international reputation. And I think this is certainly the reason why the Americans would use him or would establish him as the founding director. And also, which I found interesting, at first within this group discussing the idea of a Geschwister Scholl Hochschule, there was also Hans Werner Richter. And Hans Werner Richter would later become famous within German or West German literary history for being the founder of the group, Gruppe 47, as it is called in German, Group 47, which became a very influential literary group. The most known members are now certainly Günter Grass or Peter Handke, who joined them in the 60s. But he had been criticizing the idea, the American idea of a re-education of the German public in a leftist magazine. And so he sort of was pushed off the boat because of this criticism. In that respect, Bill was sort of, I think he was quite cunning. He knew that he could build one of the biggest structures ever in his life. He was very interested in this project. And that could also be another reason, I guess, because he was devising the building of the school. And of course, that was also a major factor for the success of the school, that they would be able to build a new building, similar to the Bauhaus, of course, in Dessau.
So you already mentioned that Otto Eicher actually wanted to put a very own stamp, so to speak, on the HfG Ulm. And Max Bill, on the other hand, he wanted a successor of the Bauhaus. So what did it become? What were the aims of this school? And could you still find parallels to the Bauhaus in Dessau?
Yeah, we have to look at the development of the school. The school, as you might know, was closed, has dissolved itself in 1968, so it had a very brief lifespan. And so there are several phases, and in the first 2 to 3 years, it was indeed similar to the Bauhaus, because former Bauhaus level at Dietzing in Ulm, and of course also the structure of the building was in some ways similar to the Bauhaus. And then with the younger generation, it developed into a different direction. But the best element where we can grasp the direct connection to the Bauhaus is the Grundlehre in Ulm, the basic design course, which is directly oriented on the famous Vorlehre at the Bauhaus, founded by Johannes Itten in the Bauhaus in Weimar. And Bill managed indeed to find 4 former Bauhausers to teach in Ulm. Walter Peter Hans, who taught the first course in 1953, Helene Nonne-Schmidt, Josef Albers, who came twice, and for only 1 week, they also invited Johannes Itten, the founder of the Vorkurs of the Bauhaus, to teach at the school. And so in the first year, again, this is important, the first year was compulsory for all students. You could not sort of jump over the first year if you had already done a similar education. So it was compulsory. And again, this is very similar to what the Bauhaus had in mind for the education of their students.
I don't know if you know that, but probably you do as head of the archive, because you know all the documents in the archives. So what was the content of the Grundlehre at the HfG Ulm that Peter Hans taught? Was it very similar to what Albers, Moholy-Nagy or Itten did at the Bauhaus, or was it something completely different and new?
It was something completely different and new, actually. Walter Peter Hans was the founder of the photography class at the Bauhaus, but did not teach, to my knowledge, any Vorkurs at the Bauhaus. He had to emigrate, and Mies van der Rohe asked him to join him in Chicago. And there he introduced a course which he called visual training, which is still being taught today, actually. And this set of assignments he brought with him to Ulm, and thanks to the documentation of the students and also very elaborate notes by Otto Eicher, we know exactly everything, what he wanted to do with these assignments, what the assignments were, even what kind of material they were supposed to buy and use. And so this is a very different approach to Albers especially, I would say, because we have also letters exchanged between Bill and Peter Hans. Bill had tried to keep Peter Hans in Ulm, but was not really successful. And Peter Hans had to leave again back to the States. And in one of the letters, Peter Hans is really criticizing the approach of Albers, for example. So he said, well, I have seen so many folding classes of the Bauhaus kindergarten, as he actually says. Basically, he says, I don't see any future in this kind of approach. yeah, that's really an interesting turn of events, I guess. And so Albers again, then he had been head of the Forecourse at the Bauhaus. And we should not forget that, again, Albers had to emigrate and he was teaching at Black Mountain College in North Carolina. And there he used assignments from the Bauhaus time, but also he developed new assignments. And these, in combination, he brought back to Ulm. And so his approach was more like trial and error. He allowed intuition. And what I like, and which is sort of quite contemporary for today, he sort of sent the students out to the city to collect material, and they had to use found materials as they were not allowed to buy anything. And they had to be very economic about the use of material. But if you compare the results of the assignments of Peter Hans and Albers, they are really completely different. With Helene Nonne-Schmidt, it was quite a systematic approach because she was teaching color theory and color systematics. And what is interesting that she also taught the color theory, or the color system, I should rather say, by Ostwald, who famously gave one lecture at the Bauhaus in the late 20s, which she most likely heard. So his color system was that a printer in the US, a printer in Italy, a printer in France would be able to reproduce the exact kind of blue maybe, or yellow or so on, based on his color system. And students had to do these selection of assignments connected to that. Helene Nonne-Schmidt, she had known Bill at the Bauhaus actually as a student, and she had also studied with Paul Klee. And so she also taught the way Paul Klee had used watercolor. And so he was a very important source, I guess, for the direct connection of with the Bauhaus, because Bill himself, he did not teach as much as he should have. And lastly, Johannes Itten, he was there only for 1 week and was teaching assignments similar to what he did at the Bauhaus already, the warm cold contrast, the light-dark contrast, and so on. And what he also did was his famous relaxation exercises at the beginning of the class. And we have photographs of the students not really enjoying this, because at the time, yoga was not a thing in Germany, of course, and they just didn't seem to understand what he wanted to do with it. But that's more of a fun fact, I would say.
Well, you already mentioned that Max Bill didn't teach as much as he should have at the AFG, but I'm not letting you get away with that just like that. What did he teach at the AFG, and what should he have taught maybe?
Well, I think it was not so clearly decided what he should be teaching or how much. I mean, he was the director, but he always kept his private architectural practice in Zurich. So he was also moving between the two cities. So what he did teach in the Grundlehre was we call it in the German, the Würfelaufgabe. So the students had to make a cube with the length of 10 centimeters in plaster. And this had to be very, very exact. And we have photographs of this project. And then he also did gradations of gray. This sounds very abstract, which is in a way you would use grids. And you would sort of make the grids always denser, so which means the distances between the lines would become less and less from square to square. And by this, you would change from a light gray to an almost black. So again, this is very similar to a color systematic in a way. And there are several assignments which we can relate to Max Bill, but we do not have many examples in our archive from the students. We have much more examples of the courses by Helene Nonne-Schmidt or by Walter Peterhans, actually.
But now that you've described the content of the courses that all those former Bauhauses gave at the HFG, it seems to me that they took the framework of the Bauhaus, but they evolved it, of course, during the past years between the end of the Bauhaus in 1933 and the start of the HFG in 1953. So that's 20 years roughly in between, and very moving 20 years in between, politically seen in Germany, but probably also personally for all of them. But especially the grid system, the cube grid system that you just discussed, this one task of Max Bill at the HFG, it seems to be, for me, listening to that, it doesn't have to do with the Bauhaus
at all what was taught at the Bauhaus, but it seems to be much more into concrete art, what he did afterwards. Am I right?
I totally agree with this. I mean, this is very important to mention that in the early 30s, Max Bill was in Paris and he was part of the group Abstraction Création, which famously developed the idea of concrete art or concrete Kunst in opposition to abstract art. This again is one of his major contributions to art history, of course. And what you're mentioning there is one of the grounds for, or the reasons, I should say, for the future conflict within the school. Because Max Bill always believed that art could be a guideline, could be a guidance for designers. Although they were sort of stressing the point that the Ulm School of Design was not an art school. This is, again, a very important fight they fought because they said, we need to educate industrial designers. But Bill was nevertheless giving the arts the sort of the first role within design. And this idea was opposed very much by the younger generation, especially Thomas Maldonado. And again, this development we can grasp quite easily within the context of the Grundlehre, the first year, which was compulsory for everyone. And ironically, it was Thomas Maldonado who, together with Eicher, sort of were chasing Max Bill away. We could formulate it like that. So in 1954, Maldonado arrived at the school. Thomas Maldonado was born in Argentina in 1922. He was trained as a painter, so he's also part of the great movement of concrete artists. And in this function, he came to Switzerland because he was interested in Max Bill and wanted to write a book about him. And also, interestingly, in 1948, when first Otto Eicher and Inge Scholl visited Max Bill, on the same day, Thomas Maldonado was also at Max Bill's house. And so these four people met at this occasion, not knowing what they would be doing some years later. And so in 54, Maldonado joined the school on the invitation of Max Bill. And in 1955, he already was head of the Grundlehre and introduced his own set of assignments. And they were, again, completely different from Peter Hans, from Albers, and, of course, from Itten. And they were a group of assignments where I find you had to understand them intellectually before you would even be able to put pen or pencil to paper. So what we can find here is that he is pushing the idea of establishing design, industrial design, as a scientific discipline rather than an artistic discipline. And so later in 58, and at that time, Bill had already left, but I guess these ideas were already there within Maldonado's thinking. In 1958, Thomas Maldonado gives a lecture in Brussels on the occasion of the World Fair, and there was a design conference on this occasion. And there he talks about the Bauhaus, but also about the fact that he thinks the Bauhaus was no longer valid as a guidance for the design education. And of course, this is a very elaborate discussion, but basically he says that the Bauhaus was still too much like an artist school and the products they designed were too much relying on arts and crafts rather than industrial production ways. So they should no longer use the Bauhaus as a guideline, but they had to develop their own guidelines. And he gives the Ulm School as the ideal school at the time, at least, for this kind of new design education. And so what comes out of that and out of this discussion is a model which the Ulm School later called the Ulm model. But this intense opposition to the ideas of the Bauhaus was really sort of chasing Max Bill away, but of course Max Bill was not being chased away so easily, I would say. But there was a big conflict also within the school, and the whole conflict sort of exploded because apparently Max Bill had put a sign on his rooms saying Atelier Max Bill or Atelier Bill, meaning class of Max Bill, sort of a members only entry. And this, of course, was opposed to the idea of the school with very low hierarchies and, of course, not a typical master class system like they had at the traditional art academies, like a Beaux-Arts tradition. And so, because he had already stepped down as a rector of the school in 1956, and then they had established a sort of a group of rectors, including Maldonado and Eicher and two others. And they sort of wrote a letter to him and said, well, what you are doing is not within the guidelines of the school. You are sort of interruptive of our ideas. And you give the impression of a school within the school. And we don't want that. Please stop it. And Bill did not accept this. And so in 1957, he left the school altogether. But he took about 20 students with him, who then sort of worked out an agreement with the directors of the school in Ulm that they would be able to take their diploma within the Bill Atelier in Zurich. Some of them did, not all of them did. And so you see, this was already a very explosive situation. I mean, also losing 20 students, because at the time, the school did not have as many students as it later have. But some of the students had expressly come to Ulm because they wanted to study at the new Bauhaus with a former Bauhäusler and, of course, with Max Bühl. And again, you see here his prominence and his being well known within the art and design world at the time.
I think it's kind of ironic that it's history repeating, because what happened at the Bauhaus when Hannes Meyer came, he wanted to take the art out of the design process and put technology into the foreground and the work with the industry. And now what's happened at the HFG is that Max Bill, who studied under Hannes Meyer at the Bauhaus in 1928, he does the complete contrary and switches to, oh, we put the art on top of everything again. And that, you know, everything that Hannes Meyer did when he was at the Bauhaus, he switches at the HFG, and it becomes fatal for his position at the HFG, because also Hannes Meyer, he was all about the collective and not about the individual. This is my office and you are only allowed to do this and that if you're in my office and I am the head or stuff like that. But no, it was the contrary. It was, we are the collective and the individual is not important. The outcome is important. And I find kind of ironic that Max Bill does it the other way around, and that this is what the younger people find unattractive about him at the HFG.
Good point. And I think this also indicates in a way how political this founding of the Ulm School of Design was, of course, similar to the Bauhaus, because we should not forget that the Ulm School of Design was funded by the Americans. And I was talking about this condition that the Americans said, we will fund the school with 1 million mark if the German side would also donate as much money. And to me, I think the idea behind this is to make the Germans accept the heritage of the Geschwister Scholl, of Hans and Sophie Scholl, and their fight against the Nazi regime. Because at the time, as I told you, they were not known internationally, but within Germany, and especially within conservative circles, not only the White Rose group, but also Stauffenberg, who was fighting in 1944 against Hitler with his bombing, they were considered as traitors. And so only in 1953, there was a jurisdiction that it was forbidden to call them traitors, or Vaterlandsverräter, or Nestbeschmutzer, as they were called in German. And another thing is, I didn't talk about this, but it's a very telling episode, actually. So I talked about that Inge Scholl needed to collect this money. And when she did, she managed to get a donation of steel by the steel industry. And so Bill could devise the building as a steel skeleton building. But in 1950, a former Gestapo informant, he launched a defamation campaign, and he said not only Hans and Sophie, but also Otto Eicher and Inge, and maybe even Bill, they have leftist tendency if they are not even communists. And in 1950, this was the high tide of the McCarthy era in Washington, where this infamous guy, McCarthy, was sort of hunting communists. And we know this from the lives of Bertolt Brecht or also from Thomas Mann. They had to appear in front of commissions to prove that they were not communists or at least to exculpate themselves. And that's the reason, for example, why Thomas Mann decided to leave the U.S. because he could not tolerate this kind of treatment. For the Ulm project, it meant that they lost 1 year because they needed a lot of time to sort of tell the Americans, no, we are not communists, and so on and so on. We have letters of Bill trying to explain the situation. But all this process takes about 1 year. But as soon as this sort of defamation campaign begins and these claims are in the world, the steel industry sort of renounces this donation. And so Bill had to change the building into a concrete steel skeleton building, because even after everything was resolved, the steel industry did not renew this donation. And I'm telling you this only because Rary rightly mentioned Hannes Meyer and his ideas. But I think at the time it was, of course, known that Hannes Meyer was a communist. And I mean, he had left Germany to go to the Soviet Union. And given the background of the American situation, it would not have been helpful for the Ulm School of Design to relate to Hannes Meyer, I would suppose. And this actually would be quite interesting to look into at the time, because later at the Ulm School of Design, but this is another story, there was a student called Claude Schneid, who was also later a lecturer here at the school, and he wrote the first biography of Hannes Meyer, actually. But there you see how politics and design and intentions are closely knit together. And I mean, they were simply very interested in secure the public funding, and so they could not have any large political differences within the school at that time, at least.
And it's the more surprising that Max Bill, you said that he switched from steel skeleton to concrete skeleton building. And I always felt reminded, well, I've once visited your archive as well, a couple of years ago, I think, 2018 it was, to research for the Bauhaus Imaginista project. And when I arrived at the HFG, I felt so reminded of the trade union school here in Bernau, which I live really close by, like 10 minutes away from there. And I was so surprised because the staggering of the different building parts into the nature, like the hilly side and especially the concrete skeleton, it looked so familiar. And I thought, entering the building, that he must have copied the trade union school from Hannes Meyer and modernized it like 20 years later on. It's the more surprising that the Americans didn't see that, but probably because the trade union school was on German democratic grounds, so on GDR grounds, and they didn't know it. And it was quite famous in the 30s, but afterwards, during Second World War, I think it became unknown, kind of.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, my predecessors, they published a book about the building. They were also using Hannes Meyer's school as a comparison. And when Bill was at the Bauhaus, we know that Hannes Meyer was designing the Gewerkschaftsschule already. So he might have seen plans, we don't know that. But what I found most striking, and a very nice person at the visitor center in Bernau pointed out to me, the former design of the Bernau school with these three really massive chimneys really rising high above the main facade. And this is quite similar to the big chimney we have in front of the Mensa, in front of the cafeteria here in Ulm. And I think here he is really quoting, or at least referring to, the appearance of the Bernauer School, and also sort of stressing the point that this is a school of industrial design, because, I mean, the chimney itself is in a way a symbol of industry.
Yeah, of course. The trade union school in Bernau was mockingly called by the public the education factory. because of those three chimneys. And well, you've probably been in the dining hall as well and seen this big glass facade, and you can open half of the windows with just turning one wheel and the other half turning another one. So that was obviously copied from the industry as well. And there are more things. And the interesting thing is that the Nazis didn't change the facade. It was changed much later after the Second World War by a architectural collective, because the architect Georg Waterstraat, who designed the red building next to it, so there was like a twin building to make the whole school bigger because they had so many students. He was planning this building in 1949. And I researched that a lot because I was always interested, well, why does facade look so different? And I found out that he already had planned everything. And the SED party in Eastern Germany, they said that it's okay to build it like that. But in between was this formalism debate that so much had to do with the founding of the HFG Ulm. Because for the GDR, it was politically not attractive and, well, to maybe put it a little bit harsher, it could not be seen as politically acceptable anymore to be a supporter of the Bauhaus, even though all the Bauhaus buildings were on GDR grounds. Because Gropius and Max Bill declared the HFG Ulm to be the official successor of the Bauhaus, the GDR had to act counter-politically. And that's why Georg Waterstraat, he was involved in other projects. He became privileged to travel to France and what everyone else wasn't able to do in the GDR. And he was just taken away, this project. And then a collective with architects that we don't even know the names of anymore, they designed that entrance and decided that the chimneys would be torn down. And that's why it looks like Third Reich architecture, because those were architects that were educated during the Third Reich as architects. So that's the different histories of that building. And I always find that really interesting, parallel to the history of the HFG Ulm, of course. But yeah, maybe we could talk about the building then, because that's something that's been left from Max Bill in Ulm. Could you very shortly describe how the building is constructed, how it feels like to be in the building to walk through?
Well, the building, as I told you before, was taxed to cost 2 million by Max Bill, and they had collected that money. And when he finalized the plans in December 52, he really had to sort of let down his trousers, we say in Germany. He had to write a letter. In a letter to Inge Scholl, he had to confess, well, to make it short, he says, "We are missing the third million." That's what he wrote 1 week before Christmas in 1953. And I was found it always astonishing that Inge Scholl is answering on December 24th, which of course is a very Heiligabend, is sort of sacred in Germany. And she writes a very long letter, and she really can't hide her exasperation and her feelings of deception, and said, "Well, we trusted in you. How could this happen?" And she immediately suggests that they would have to look into possibilities, what could be done, what could be built at the school itself. So, for example, this is one reason why the Ulm Stuhl was designed eventually, because they simply didn't have money to buy chairs.
The following short part about the Ulmer Hocker, the Ulm Stuhl, Martin Mentele recorded on another day with a proper microphone. We really forgot to talk about this design icon in detail during our interview, and we thought it makes total sense to have it in our podcast anyway. That's why the audio you will hear now for the next roughly 2 minutes is much better than our interview recording. We had several technical problems in that, and I'm really sorry that the audio quality is not the best, but I wanted to use it anyway, because that's what real podcasting is like. We're not in a recording studio, it's real life and real rough podcasting without much financial backup. Here it goes.
In September, October, the wood workshop at the school was finally established. And earlier that year, another designer and architect, Hans Güjelow, had joined the staff. And so these two men, Max Bill and Hans Güjelow, apparently worked on the design for the Ulm Stuhl. This is a very simple piece of furniture. It mainly consists of three
spruce boards, two vertical and one horizontal for the seat, plus a round bar, which they suggested to use as a kind of handle and also for stabilization. And there are two smaller parts of wood as a support on the vertical boards. So they could build that themselves at the school's wood workshop, as I told you, but the finger joint was a bit of a problem. And so they asked the craftsman, Paul Hildinger. He was the master of the wood workshop, and Josef Schlecker, he was the master of the metal workshop, for help. And these two craftsmen apparently developed a kind of device with which these finger joints could be produced more easily and quite cost efficiently. You must imagine that they did not have enough money to buy chairs. They had intended to spend about 30 marks per chair. We know this from a list of furniture they wanted to buy. They did not have this money, and the Ulm stool cost them at the time about 5 to 6 marks. So this was a very good solution at the time. They did not intend it to become a design icon, but that is a completely different story.
And I'm telling you this only because Bill had to save money wherever he could. The topological situation is slightly hilly, so we have sort of a soft rolling hill. And he's using this hill to organize the different three main parts of the building on three different levels. So we have the mensa, the cafeteria level, which is sort of the lowest level. And then we have a second level with the rector's office and the library and secretary and all these administration kind of offices. And then we have the top level with the different departments and the workshops. And they are all put in a sequence and connected through staircases. So they are not stacked atop on each other, but they are sort of sloping down the hill, I could say. And directly connected to the cafeteria part begins a corridor which connects the different student quarters and the student halls. And there we find, I think, the most striking similarity to Bernau. If you come today to Ulm, you only see one large student hall, which we call the Wohnturm, plus adjoining smaller wings for the studios, which have about 2 stories. And I think the student hall, the tower, has maybe 8. But Bill had intended to build 3 of these towers and sort of linking them together along the hillside. And this would have been very similar to the situation in Bernau. And he connected all these buildings with an open air corridor, but where you could sort of walk with a dry head into the main building. And of course, what Meyer does in Bernau, that he has a glass corridor connecting all the different living quarters, which of course is much nicer, especially in the winter. But they couldn't afford that. And I think that he never even thought about this. So these are similarities to Bernau, but there are also structural similarities to Dessau, I would suggest. For example, you can sort of wake up in the Wohnturm and via this corridor access directly the main building. And this is, of course, the same situation like you have at the Prellerturm in Dessau. You go down in the first floor, have breakfast, and then can go to your lessons or to the workshop without ever leaving the building. And this is the same idea here in Ulm. And also similar to the Bauhaus, Bill designed a couple of double houses, which were used by the lecturers, similar to the Meisterhäuser in Dessau. And the houses here are even closer to the main school building than they are in Dessau. It's maybe a 3 minutes walk to the first of them. But again, he didn't have enough money, so that he just built 6 units, actually, although he had intended to build more. And interestingly, and not many people know this, the first house in the sequence of houses for the lecturers, he wanted to build his own house. And this, again, not a double house, but a single house, a detached house, similar to Gropius in Dessau, who had not a double house like Klee and Kandinsky or the others, but who had a house for himself, which has been luckily restored in the last couple of years. So that's a very telling similarity to the Bauhaus, and also, I think, in a way, very telling about the personality of Max Bill. But this never came to be because they didn't have the funds to do it, and the foundation was not really happy about this idea because it was really a large house. I think it had about 300 square meters or something like that, which is a very large house. The Bauhaus building when Max Bill was studying there was brand new, and I think it must have been one of the most exciting experiences, which then would become world famous, and that can be quite influential for such a young person. I mean, he was still in his early 20s when he was there.
When I was talking to his widow, Angela Thomas, she also said that there is a strong possibility that he visited Brunau in 1929 and perhaps even worked there on the building site, because there's like a big blank in 1929. And she only found out that he had been in Berlin, and the office for Brunau by Hannes Meyer was in Berlin. And Ariel Sharon was the head of this office after Hans Bitwer went away from the Bauhaus and also left Bernau to go to Burg Giebichenstein in Halle and become head of the carpentry and the architectural class there. And Ari Scheron and Max Bill, they were pretty close friends even later after that time at the Bauhaus. So there is a strong possibility that Max Bill was in Bernau, or at least knew the competition entries, because, of course, those in 1928, it was published in the Bauhaus journal, and it was probably also exhibited at the Bauhaus, I would guess, because, I mean, it was the Bauhaus project under the era of Hannes Meyer, and was the only Bauhaus building that was built from the inside and from the outside by the Bauhaus, apart from the Bauhaus building itself. So I think that would be something really triggering for me to find out if Max Bill was really part of that building site in Bernau, or if he knew in more detail about the building and why it kind of inspired him for his own buildings at the HFG. Because I think it's quite obviously, you mentioned it already, it's a mixture of the Bauhaus in Dessau and the Bauhaus building in Bernau, but of course a much more modern version of both of it. Of the 50s.
Exactly. And we have to point this out to people who don't know the buildings. It's not painted white. It's the pure concrete. It's gray in appearance. And so it's really very different to the impression in Bernau, where you sort of brick is the main impression. And of course, in Dessau, where you have white and the black and white facade, or the white facade in contrast to the black window frames at the Werkstattgebäude as the main impression. Yeah.
Yeah. So you already mentioned that the HFG closed in 1968 for good. Why did it close in the end? What was the trace from Max Bill's leaving in 1957 for good to 1968 to fully closing it?
Similar to the Bauhaus, we have to stress that Ulm School of Design dissolved itself. In some of the older literature, you would find the formulation that the school was closed by Hans Filbinger, the then minister president of Baden-Württemberg. But this could not be, because the Ulm School of Design was always a privately run school, which was supported by the Geschwister Scholl Foundation, which was funded in 1950 by Inge Scholl in order to collect and administrate the money they were trying to find for the school building and for the running of the school. And so we have three main reasons. They are financial, personal, and political, I would say. So let's begin with the finances. In 1966, the foundation suddenly found that they had large debts at the bank, that they were in debt with about 400,000 marks. And apparently they did not do an annual review at one time. But we also have to point out that the school was never sticking to its budget, apparently. And so that was a big problem, of course. And in 66, 67, the West German government decided that the funding of university level education was supposed to be paid by the different Bundesländer, not by the federal state, but by the Bundesländer. In this case, that would mean Baden-Württemberg. And so another big part of the funding, about 200,000 marks, were suddenly gone. And also we have to say that in 66, 67, for the first time, the national income would not grow anymore. It was the first sort of break in this continuous growth after World War II, and there was a high inflation, and so they did not have any attractive or lucrative contract works with the industry, because this was one of the arguments when they were founding the school, that they would fund themselves by doing work for the industry and by also charging student fees, which never really worked out. And to stress this point even more, so the school was privately run, but it was dependent for over more than 50% by public money. And so in 66, 67, we all, at that time, the school was looked on as being a very divisive school and not easy to deal with. And so in 67, and now I come to the personal reasons, Tomas Maldonado left the school because he wanted to write a book. He left for the States, where he got a grant to write a very important book. And Otto Eicher, he was awarded the contract for the corporate identity for the Munich Olympics in 72. So he also left the school. And so two very influential figures were no longer around, or at least not as present as before. Because Eicher stayed to teach, but he was not in any responsible function anymore. And the last rector of the school, Herbert Ohl, even contemporaries say he was not really the right person to deal with the politicians, apparently. And so in 68, it was very clear that they would run out of money for the new study year 68, 69. And for legal reasons, they had to let people go, and they had to inform them as early as March, apparently. But already in February, there was a vote by the students and by the lecturers, and by the whole staff, actually, of the school, that they would rather dissolve themselves than accept any kind of compromise. And one of these compromises, which was discussed or suggested by the politicians in Stuttgart, was that to make it a state school, to join the Ulm School of Design with a newly founded engineer school in Ulm, which actually still exists. But as soon as this was suggested, they took this discussion to the public, and we can find reports in the local paper that they were fighting about who would then be the director and who would then have sort of the say at the school. And another idea was to establish the Ulm School of Design as a postgraduate study at Stuttgart University for design, that's specializing in design, but sort of functioning in Ulm. But both these ideas were rejected. And the cultural ministry in Stuttgart, they set ultimata, but then nothing worked out and they didn't come together in any way. And so for the new study of 68, 69, only 40 students returned. And so the lecturers refused to teach at all. So teaching had already stopped in the fall of 68. And by the end of the year, they simply closed the school. Ironically, the Landesregierung was not freezing the money anymore in November 68, but it was simply too late to reestablish the lectures and so on. And so they only had the option to close the school in December.
So I have to ask, because 1968 is a politically loaded year, it didn't have to do with the student movement that took place in that year especially.
Of course it did. I mean, I sort of omitted the political reasons. I mean, I talked about the financial, the personal, and now I should talk about the political reasons. You are absolutely right. It has to do with the student revolt in some ways. And again, this starts earlier, because in 66, they collected money for the victims of the Vietnam War, but without any kind of official permit down in the city of Ulm. And the Lord Mayor was really upset. City of Ulm was always also giving money to the school, but they had not acquired a permit for this action. And that was, again, a cause for scandal. And of course, in 67, after the murder of Benno Ohnesorg in West Berlin, there was a demonstration. So the new generation, or the generation studying at that time at the Ulm School of Design, they were similarly upset like students in all other cities, because, I mean, we know in 65, they started the Auschwitz processes in Frankfurt and so on and so on. So they were simply opposing the elders, I would say. And I know from a former head of the metal workshop, and he was a union man, so he was already a leftist guy, I would say. He always tells me that the students try to make him a communist, that he would join the Communist Party. And of course, the school had a very leftist bend. Maldonado is certainly a prime example of being caviar gauche, as the French call this. And I mean, I don't blame him for this, but this doesn't really help if you have to save the school. And we could also say that the general upheaval of the younger generation in that case did not really help regarding saving the school, because it was simply not clear how would they finance themselves, how would they organize themselves, who would be the rector in the future, would this school need even more funding, because they were also criticizing they had too few output, that there was not enough being done at the school at the time, and so on and so on. So it is really a very complex situation. And to give you another idea of the turmoil, maybe I could say, at the school, there was indeed, we have letters, interest by André Malraux, the then culture minister in France, very famous cultural minister, to establish the school in Paris, actually, or to bring it to France. And even a student delegation traveled to France to talk with him or to talk with some people in France, in Paris, about it. But they sort of got lost in the May of 68 in the student revolt in Paris. But one of the students told the Frankfurter Allgemeine, one of the leading German newspapers, that the school would go to Paris. But then Herbert Ohl, he had to publish a dementi the next day in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung saying, no, we are still talking to Stuttgart, we are not going to Paris. And this is a wonderful example how the situation was sort of completely out of control, because the students did this, Ohl did that, and so they really couldn't fight together in one direction in order to save the school. And as I told you before, they were really decided, they were determined as early as February 68 that they would not accept any kind of compromise, because they said, our school was founded in the memory of Hans and Sophie Scholl, who fought their freedom, who lost their lives fighting for the freedom, and we see ourselves in this tradition. And now we could, of course, talk about, is this a useful attitude? I don't want to decide, but this illustrates you very clearly how difficult the situation was. Maybe it could not be resolved at the time.
So after the HFG closed, what happened to the building and what is there happening today?
After the school was closed, some of the workshop masters, they tried to keep the workshops alive, and they tried to find contract works or work to make money, but this didn't really last a long time. And then for a very brief time, for about 3 years, there was the Institute for Umweltplanung. So we could translate this for Institute for Planning, and that was already connected to Stuttgart University, and this gave some of the younger students the opportunity to finish their studies and receive their diploma, and some even made a doctorate, actually. But that collapsed again 3 years later in 72. And then the University of Ulm, which was only founded in 67, if I'm not mistaken, which was so still young and they were growing and they needed space, they took over the school and also the student halls. And they established different functions, and one main function was a psychosomatic clinic on one side and the Department for Anthropology on the other side of the building. And they used the building until about 2008 or 2009. For the clinic, there was a new building and they moved there. And so everyone moved out. And the foundation, which is now called Stiftung Hochschule für Gestaltung, HFG Ulm, who still owns most of the campus, they decided to establish a design center, trying to find renters somehow related to design in general. And so the city council of Ulm decided that the archive, the HFG archive, which was at a different place in town, would be moved to the actual site, and that we would also receive some kind of exhibition space, because up to then there was not a real proper exhibition space within the archive, actually. And so the archive was established here in 2011, and our permanent exhibition was opened in 2013. And so the other rooms are now rented out to photographers, engineers, marketing agencies, a large jewelry company, which is a traditional company from Ulm, and interestingly, a small private clinic for psychotherapy is now also again in the building. So at the moment, all rooms are rented out, and so the building is thriving in a way.
My very last question, Herr Mentele, it's could you pick out one or two products of the HFG Ulm that's probably also part of your permanent exhibition that became iconic and telling for the HFG and are known to most people? And could you describe them a little bit to the listeners and tell us why do you think that they become so iconic?
Well, there are two obvious competitors for this. The first one, the older one from 1956, is the SK4, better known as Snow White's Coffin, a compact radio and record appliance manufactured by the Brown Company. And the second one is the TC100, a stackable tableware designed by Hans Nick Röhricht in 1958 and then produced from 1961 onwards. Both of them were very early accepted by the Museum of Modern Art in New York in their design collections. I've always compared to become a knight. So this is sort of the knighthood for designers if their work is accepted in the collection. The compact appliance, the SK4 or Snow White's Coffin, is really a new approach to this kind of appliance, because up to then, radios or record players were hidden away in large pieces of furniture, and they were quite heavy. You could not move them around yourselves. And so they did everything contrarily to that. So the main designer on this project is Hans Gügelow, who also taught at the school, an architect by training, by the way. And instead of using a full body made completely out of wood, he is only using flanks made in wood. And the main body of the appliance is made from bent metal. And this bent metal was then lacquered in crisp white, which again was a new approach, because at the time, clean white would not be acceptable for a living room. They would use ivory white maybe or eggshell, but never, as they called it in German, Krankenhaus white, hospital white. But he did. Of course, the nickname is derives from the color, but also from the fact that Dieter Rams, who at that time was already working for Braun, though only briefly, he suggested to use acrylic glass for the lid, making the lid transparent. And by this, they designed a new type for this kind of machinery, for this kind of appliance. And in the future, most of the record players would have a kind of transparent or semi-transparent cover. And if you look closely at the design, what is typical for Gügelow's designs are so-called Engelradien in German. We call it narrow angles, which makes the edges very smooth. And together with the whiteness and the smooth edges and the transparency, this is really the DNA for Jonathan Ive's work for Apple from about 20 or 30 years ago. So in a way, the idea of Apple design, or some ideas, let's say some ideas, Apple design, at least from Jonathan Ives onwards, were designed or thought about in Ulm. And that's why it's certainly iconic. So like the Apple products are the must-haves of today, in 1956, the SK4 was a must-have. And it was similarly expensive because it cost about 290 marks. Which was a month's salary of a teacher or a policeman, apparently. And so the second contender is, in my eyes, the TC100, the stackable tableware. Again, interestingly, the C stands for compact, and it's a stackable tableware based on a grid, and every element with the same diameter could be stacked on top of each other. And I always use it as an example to explain what the Ulm model meant, because the basic idea of Hans Nick-Röhrich, who later became professor in Berlin, and he himself educated many future professors of design, and his main idea, his basic idea was to use a double cylinder for this shape, for the cups and so on. But double cylinder cannot be produced. You have to have some kind of slant. In German, we have the very nice word Ausformschräge or Entformungsschräge, which needs to be at least 2 degrees as an angle, maybe 1.5. But you need this kind of slant in order to be able to remove something from a mold smoothly. I always compare it to a muffin baking tray. It also is slanted in order to remove the muffin quickly. And this is what the Ulm model is about, that the designer has to accept these technical reasons, and he then has to adapt his design accordingly to these technical expectations. And I could talk more in detail about further elements in this design. Also, he did some research. For example, he talked to dishwasher manufacturers, and they always told them to make sure that the water jet gets everywhere so that the china gets clean, and also make sure that there are no recesses that the water can dry off completely. And again, this has nothing to do with aesthetics. It has to do with function. But the designer has to collect all these data and put them into his design in order to make a successful product. And there you really can grasp the difference between design and art, because an artist might claim the most beautiful stackable cup looks like this for me. I don't accept any kind of compromise, but it would never be produced. And the designer has to accept the technical framework for his design and then adapt his design, and only then his work will be produced. And again, it was quite a successful work. The cups were then produced by Thomas, a company which belonged to Rosenthal at the time, one of the most famous manufacturers in Western Germany at the time. And it was produced continuously until 2006 or 8.
I think it's quite interesting. I don't know if you know Mitropa dish from the GDR. I grew up with that kind of dish. And when I saw the first time at the HFG Ulm exhibition, the stackable dish of the HFG, I felt so reminded of that. And I always wondered what came first, the HFG dish or the Mitropa dish, or was it a zeitgeist thing, you know, that just evolved during that time?
Yeah, I think it would be both. And the Mitropa, I think it's slightly earlier. But again, we would have to look really into the development of the whole process. And also, I think it has not really been done so much research about the exchange between West German and East German design and designers. I mean, there was this big exhibition by Vitra where they showed the stackable tableware by Röhrich, but also GDR design, because everybody sees this similarity. But I think there are still some questions to be answered.
Yeah, it's always good to discover new parts that still have to be researched and people can write PhD theses about. Mr. Menschler, thank you very much for joining me today. It was a great pleasure, against all technical odds, and see you soon.
We'll manage this bravely together.